First three messages. Who's the lawyer that founders in the Mixergy audience trust? Scott Edward Walker of Walker Corporate Law. Have you seen what Chris Pritchard posted on my Facebook page? His new companies and corporation pages that Scott Edward Walker helped him get. Scott Edward Walker is the lawyer that publications like Forbes trust. Go to walkercorporatelaw.com. Next, when my friend had to close her company's office but still wanted to give callers the impression that all her employees work well under one roof together, what service did she use? Grasshopper. With Grasshopper, everyone who works for you could have an extension. They can pick up calls on their extensions no matter where they are or what phones they use, and they can transfer calls to each other back and forth with ease. Get those features and tons more at grasshopper.com. Finally, when Dave Jackson and Dave Petrillo invented a product that keeps coffee at the perfect temperature, what platform did they use to create their online store? Shopify.com. Look at how beautiful their store looks. It's because it's built on Shopify. They did hundreds of thousands of dollars in sales. Shopify stores are designed to help you sell. Patrick Buckley invented an iPad case and used Shopify as his online store. Within months, he sold over $1 million in cases. Get your beautiful online store at Shopify.com. Here's a program. Hey there, Freedom Fighters. My name is Andrew Warner, and I'm the founder of Mixergy, home of the ambitious upstart, and the place where founders come to tell the stories of how they built up their businesses. And in this interview, we've got the story of a former QuickBooks developer who launched a financial software company of his own. In 2008, Ben Curran co-founded Outright, which makes simple online bookkeeping software for small business owners. About 5 years later, he sold the company to GoDaddy. Ben, welcome.
Welcome. Thanks for having me.
What did you guys sell for?
What did we sell for?
What was the exit price, the sale price?
So the sale price is not public. Both companies are private, so we're not disclosing the details of the financials. So I can talk about the sale in general, though, where GoDaddy is continuing to invest in Outright as the product. We're continuing to grow and invest further. So next year, we're hiring another 15 engineers. We're planning to grow another 10x. And we're continuing to build and improve on the product.
Okay. Did you guys get money from the exit too, or was it just the investors?
So yeah, employees did well, the founders and investors.
Okay. And you raised what, $17 million, I think?
So we raised 7.5.
Oh, of course, 7.5 million. I don't know why I added an extra one to that.
Yep, so 7.5 from Sequoia and First Round Capital and Shasta and a group of angels.
All right, let's get into this. We'll talk about how the company got this big and what are some of the issues along the way and what are some of the successes. And it all started when, this is after you left Intuit where you worked on QuickBooks. You had your own company, right? I guess it was a consulting company you started while you were at Intuit?
That's right. So even before Intuit, I've gone back and forth between consulting and working for startups. And after leaving Intuit, I was working on QuickBooks, and I decided to start another consulting company. That consulting company, I was pretty opinionated on the types of technologies I wanted to work in. We were really small, so I was very particular on the projects and the clients and the technology. And it was really things that I was generally interested in and wanted to learn more about. So I did all Ruby on Rails development, specifically on greenfield type projects.
And one of the issues that you had was that you didn't like the bookkeeping software that you had to use, right?
That's right. So previous to that consulting company, I actually ran a business using QuickBooks. So I've actually been through that learning curve and struggled with learning all the accounting jargon. However, this time around, there was a couple of major differences. I brought on a business partner, Kevin Reith, who also founded Outright. So I had to start sharing my books with him. And then I also moved from a Windows machine to Mac, and I had to run Parallels to run QuickBooks. So those two things made QuickBooks really painful for me on a day-to-day basis to run my business. So I spent time looking around for an alternative, assuming I tried QuickBooks Online, and that only worked on IE6, so I had to use Windows still. It was also very cumbersome. And so eventually, I knew a lot about this space. We built a small version that we were actually able to use to run our consulting company.
You built a small version of what?
Of Outright.
Oh, really? Just for your own company?
Yeah, so we built, when running that company, it was called Esomni. We built about five products. So we built an expense tracking product. We built like a billing project. We built bookkeeping. And all of it was kind of eat your own dog food. Like, we used it, and then we would share it, put it out to our friends and family, get feedback, and try to turn them into real products.
Okay. And how are those products doing?
Well, so out of those five, a couple got some traction. So we had an expense tracking. It was called Paybackable, and we had about 5,000 customers had people paying us. But Outright, which was called Bootstrap when we first started, that actually had more traction and a lot better feedback. And that's where we ended up really placing all of our chips after these five were going, and we raised a seed round, and then spent all of our time exclusively on that product.
By the way, why is it that so many consulting companies create their own expense software? It feels like there are tons of expense programs out there.
Yeah, it's a good question. So it's just every company you tend to end up getting your own billing practices and the way you manage. Like, we happen to have contractors and only like a couple employees, and our contracts, we did fixed bid plus like markup on contractors. So we had all these different ways of billing that were really in particular to the way we ran our business. And I think what happens is, like, to build software that can handle all those cases, it has to get really, really complicated. And we want something simple. And yeah, you always think like, oh, I'll build this little thing for me because I understand it all and it's simpler and it works for something for us. And I think that's, at least for me, why we did that.
So Ben, what I see here are two different products. I know you launched several products, but there are two different products that are scratching your own itch. One of them didn't get huge. The other one got big enough to be acquired by GoDaddy. What's the difference in the way that you built them out for scratch? So, you know, the scratch your own itch thing, it's supposed to be the cure-all. You need a business product, think about your own issues. Great, come up with your own solution to your own issue, and there must be other people who share that problem who are willing to pay for the solution that you were so desperate for that you built it. What's the difference in the way that those two played out?
Well, I think it's a good question. So definitely scratch your own itch is great because you're your own customer. So, you know, if you've ever worked on products where you would not use the software, it's really hard to put yourself in the head of a customer to make all those decisions. So now to make decisions like, oh, would I want this feature or that feature, you have to go talk to people. And then now your feedback loop is just slowed down a lot. So to me, that's why scratch your own itch really works, because you can in your head really quickly iterate through, oh, I would do this over that. I'm not sure about this one, so I'll test it.
And that's what I keep telling Jason Fried of 37. I mean, that's what Jason Fried of 37 Signals keeps telling me when I interview him. And then my answer to him is always, but what if you have a very specific issue and you solve it in a way that makes sense just to you, and then you take it out into the world? People don't necessarily have that exact issue the way that you did and don't understand the way that you've solved it.
And that I would agree. And I think that's like the next step, which is, but just because you built something that's great for you does not mean it's great for everyone. Now, you're probably, I would say that you're more on track than building something that's not great for anyone, right? Like, which is like you're not even understanding what you're building. But yeah, is it now scalable to the mass market, and how many people are going to buy that product? That's a whole nother question. And when you start looking to build products, you know, where you want to have millions and millions of customers, like, yeah, it has to be really simple. And to be simple, you can't have too many options, which means, you know, like, so it's that fine balance of simplicity with power that you really have to find that sweet spot.
So is what you did, basically, you put both of them out to customers, Payable and Outright, which was called Bootstrap at the time, and one just caught fire and the other didn't, and that's how you know if a scratch your own itch product makes sense as a full-blown business. You put it out there and you see if it catches fire.
That's right. And I tell people, come up to me all the time now and they're like, oh, I have this idea, tell me what you think. I'm like, don't ask me, like, I don't know if that your product's going to do well. Like, the easiest thing to do is to think, what's the core idea here? How do you test that? And how do you get your potential customers to look at it and tell you whether they're going to use it or not? And hopefully you get your data by them actually using it, not them saying they're going to use it. So that to me is what matters. So when people come to me advice, the first thing I say is, well, why don't, you know, I don't know anything. I don't know anything about your product and your customers. Hopefully you know more than me about it. And truthfully, you probably can't possibly know. So why don't you try it out?
What was the core of the product at Outright?
So the core of the product at the beginning was just track income and expense. It was very simple. We talked to lots of potential customers. So we went out and said, okay, we know how we run a business. I've ran other businesses before. Well, how do other people? And luckily, I knew a bit about small businesses from being at Intuit for a while. So we found some and we looked. And most businesses who aren't on QuickBooks use spreadsheets or they don't do anything. And if you looked at spreadsheets, they really have two tabs. Like almost everyone we found had two tabs, a list of income, a list of expenses. So that's literally our very first version of the product was tabs at the top, a dashboard page, which gave an overview, a tab that had your income, a tab that had expenses, and a couple of reports. That was our very first version of Outright.
And I could have sworn, I used the first version that you guys launched, I could have sworn it sucked in my data from PayPal. Or is that later?
Yeah, so our very first integration was FreshBooks for invoices, because once again, that's what we used FreshBooks to do invoicing. So that was the natural first thing to bring in. And yes, and then eventually we brought in PayPal.
How did you know that people had two different tabs? Is this from your work at Intuit, you said?
Yeah, so some of it was from there, and then some of it is we talk to potential customers. So you just you go out and start, you know, put on Craigslist looking for people with like one employee running their business will give you, you know, $20 to talk to them. And you just ask them questions and find out what they're doing and ask them for their spreadsheets.
And for a couple of bucks, people invited you into their homes or offices and let you watch their financial system.
That's right.
How many people did you do this with?
We did it for, if I remember correctly, it was between 20 and 30 people. You find, I think it's enough when you start to see, like, you talk to people and they're saying the same. You're starting to not learn new things anymore. You're like, oh, okay, I've kind of heard that before. I've heard that before. You're like, okay. So you're starting to kind of see that. And you need to be careful. You don't want to talk to all the exact same types of people. But I also wouldn't say go too crazy about your methodology and spend forever worrying about it and not doing it.
Did you try to look for a specific kind of segment? Did you say to yourself, I'm looking for people who have businesses that are all on eBay or all online, or I'm looking for shopkeepers?
Yeah. So actually what's funny is originally we were really focusing on professional services because that's kind of what we did. And then a little bit later we pivoted to e-commerce because we really found they were a great segment.
But when you were on Craigslist, you said, is there anyone who's a consultant out there that we can pay 20 bucks to or a few bucks to and come watch the way that they keep track of their finances?
That's right. Yep. And then we also, it's the circles we ran in, right? So I hired contractors, so we had them, you know, so you can immediately start, like, we just knew a bunch of people in that area.
I see. What else? What did you discover that you could have been distracted by? I understand seeing that trend of two different tabs open and saying, aha, this is what they need. But I also see distractions possibly sending you in the wrong direction. Were there any?
Yeah, so like a good example would be taxes. So it was really tough at the beginning to say, like, see, you're going to bring in data, and because of that, we can help you run your business better, and we can help you do your taxes. But like, how far do you want to go on taxes is a really important question. You know, like, do you want to be like a TurboTax where eventually you're going in and like actually filling out all of the forms? Well, we didn't really want to go there. So yes, that could have been a huge distraction to really get focused in on taxes and to say, oh, we want to handle C Corp. We want to handle partnerships. We want to handle. So we really focused and said, look, we're going to work on sole proprietors, okay, who are, you know, mainly are getting, who will be filling their Schedule Cs out. And then we said, hey, we're not going to go further than a Schedule C. Like, our software will create a Schedule C, which will itemize what their income and expenses were, and then they're going to go into TurboTax and put in their Schedule C. And I think that, to me, was the right depth into taxes to get into. And then we helped a little with estimated taxes. So a lot of the times what we looked at is to say, if you were working for an employer and you were being W-2'd, like a normal employee, what activities would you have to do at the end of the year? And then we're like, now if you did that same job but you were a freelancer, what would you have to do? And we tried to take the additional activities and remove them or have our software take those for you. And some of those things are estimated taxes and dealing with Schedule Cs.
All right, so you knew your own problem. You watched other people as they interacted with or as they recorded their income and expenses. Was time to launch a product at that point, or did you launch it and then go talk to them?
So because we kind of knew a bit about this space, because we were writing it for ourselves, we actually built quite a bit while researching and then launched it and then to validate. You just find that, like, I'm sure people have heard this before, but you'll just find what people say and what they do are different, you know? And so it's great to go out and say, hey, would you use something like this, or what features would you like? But at the end of the day, you want to put it out there and to see them actually using it.
How long did it take you to launch?
So, I mean, our initial version was like probably 4 to 6 weeks of building.
And this had the link at the top for spending, a link at the top for income, and an overview.
Yep, overview and little bit of taxes. So, a little bit of taxes, mainly on the Schedule C.
Of all of it, what do you wish you'd, at this point, done differently?
So, good question. So, a little bit later, we really thought about, like, automating data. So, like, one of the things that we really did is once we put all of this in the cloud, we said, hey, what additional capabilities can we tap into? By being online all the time. And a lot of that is that what you find is you're always tracking your spending twice. Like, you'll go spend money on your credit card, and then you're going to go look at your bank account, and then you have to type that in as an expense. And same thing with income. I go into FreshBooks, I would send an invoice, and then I have to say, like, oh, okay, now that person paid me $5,000. I got to type it into my income. And, being in software, like, that stuff just drove me crazy. Like, why do I have to, like, do that twice? So that's really when we started saying, well, why don't we just connect right into all of these various sources? We saw, like, Wasabi at the time, and Mint was starting to do some, was around at the time too, I remember. For personal finances. And so we kind of took that and said, well, hey, for a business, you actually need to know a lot more about your income than expenses. So we really went after income sources, which you can't get from bank accounts. And that's why we really tapped into FreshBooks and eBay and in places like this, because that's where income is flowing through. Where Mint, all they really have to deal with is paychecks mainly. Like, oh, okay, you have this deposit in your bank account. Well, it's most likely a transfer, or it's your paycheck, right? You know, maybe some interest. Businesses, on the other hand, they really want to understand their income. Like, oh, what products did I sell to what customers, for how much, how many units? Like, those are the things that you just can't ever get from a bank account. So that's where we started.
How long did it take you to make that key realization?
So I think as soon as we kind of started using it and we were doing that with FreshBooks, we were like, look, we got to try this with FreshBooks. So we tried it with FreshBooks. We did an integration. We put that out. And then we just started running analysis. We said, look, people who sign up and use FreshBooks, I can't remember the exact numbers at this point, but there was something you would look out 2 months later and you're like, that person is still around. And people that are manually typing things in, like, it was like a 6% would still be around. And people who are automating it with FreshBooks, like, you know, something like 70% were still around. And we're like, aha, this is really important. And then I dug into the data more, and I'm like, other interesting things are, if they're going to add FreshBooks, they add it within like the first 2 to 3 days after signing up. So then we're like, okay, well, right when they sign up, we've got to make sure that they're adding their FreshBooks or some of those data imports.
To make all this make sense and be useful, you have to have enough customers go through your system. How did you get customers in the beginning?
Well, so a lot of it, yeah, to drive traffic, we did SEM. So, you know, it's always important when you're building a business, like, you get a lot of this with engineers that I talk to, where they're so into building products that they start missing that, like, yeah, you build a great product, but you need a lot of people to be able to know about it and to buy it and use it. And so you really need to focus on customer acquisition and where you're finding these customers. So one of the things that we have was, like, Okay, well, let's look at SEM. Can we drive down the cost of SEM enough to, you know, to warrant that as an actual channel of customer acquisition? We also wanted traffic to test. So it actually ended up working out well because we could drive traffic through SEM and then see while we're testing to see what the cost to acquire a customer would be.
And this is all along with your own money as you're still bootstrapping?
Yes. Yeah. Because to run, you know, so like the, at the time, the general, we generally had 100 conversions to test something. That's what, you know, around the number. Now, I know that's not 100% scientific, but we're not like, we're looking for order of magnitude between two different things, right? So in general, it was a good a threshold. So, you know, so we had to drive 100 people through. We were being pretty cheap on it. And yeah, and then eventually when we raised a seed round, we did a lot more SEM testing. But at the beginning, yeah, we ran some tests, drove traffic, and it would experiment.
You told April, who pre-interviewed you, that you guys used to have to find a way to make your customer work and your own product work fit in together into, you know, limited hours that we all have during the week. How'd you do it?
It was tough. I mean, really, really difficult. Especially when running a consulting company, you have people that are willing to pay you lots of money per hour. And then you're like, you're essentially saying no. And instead, you're using your employees who you're paying to work on a product. So we used to do things like we would say every Friday we would work on it and then and nights, essentially. And it was just hard. Like, you would always get project work, you know, bleeding into Fridays and bleeding in, you know, when something's important, you're going to do it for your client on the weekend. And that's really, it was just a constant battle of really protecting that time. And it was so nice when we finally were able to just focus on Outright and just to iterate on it. Like, you just move so much faster without switching context and just being able to focus.
What was the switch that allowed you to do it?
So at the end of the day, what it was is we saved up enough. We essentially closed down the consulting company, put the money we made into a bank account, and just went about 2 months exclusively working on Outright. And then after about 2 months, 2 to 3 months in getting some traction, we started raising capital. Actually, we raised capital. I was building the product while Kevin was out talking to investors.
What was your experience at the time raising money?
Both of us had zero experience raising capital. We've learned, I mean, it. You know, one of the things that I learned the most about is just investors and really understanding the way they think about investing in a business. And that really helps on communicating your ideas to them in the right way so they understand.
What do you mean? What were you like before you understood this and how did things change after?
I mean, I would go into original board meetings with like literally like ASCII text of bullet points, usually way too low level, way too low. Like, oh, here's our roadmap and here's the six exact things we're working on and how we're doing it. Like, it's just the wrong level to speak to investors. It's much better to talk about how is your product going to, how are you going to prove out product market fit? Like, that is something that they are interested in. And the details of every little feature you're going to build is kind of like, oh yeah, and we have this methodology, so we know if what we're building is accurate or not. And they like to see things like wins, like, hey, we tested these many things and these many worked. And hey, there's an interesting data point. This one worked better than that, like this feature. But in, you know, getting into the details of the product is usually not the level at which they want to communicate. So a lot of my time I had to thinking higher level. And it really actually was helpful because I was in the weeds all the time coding and building the product. So that monthly board meeting that allowed me to step back and really think strategically was extremely beneficial.
So how did you even get in the door with some of these, first round's pretty open to new entrepreneurs, of course, right? But how did a guy who never raised money before, if I understand this right, your seed came in on November 2008.
Yeah.
That was the $2 million. A couple of guys who don't have any experience. How do you do that? How do you pull that off?
And by the way, that was like the worst time and the most difficult time to be raising capital. Like,
that
I remember,
rest in peace, good times.
It was rough. So I think really, you know, when raising that seed round, you know, they really look a lot about around the team. And I think, you know, having the experience at Intuit and really understanding small businesses. Also, we had traction. Like, we actually had, I think, maybe 5,000, 6,000 customers at the time. And we were able to, like, you know, show them actual customers and people actually using our software. We could show them our software. We had a track record of building products before. So I think really those are the types of things that added to our credibility.
I see. And you say customers. Were you guys selling access?
No. So we would say, users, I guess.
Okay.
Selling, yeah. So we didn't have any revenue at all.
And you were a bootstrapper who was building a product with no revenue. Why?
Well, so really, when we started Outright, it was for us, but we really wanted it to be for, if you really look at it, there's, you know, about 24 million small businesses in the U.S., and a majority of them are using spreadsheets or absolutely nothing or paper. And I mean like 20-something million of them. Mm-hmm. And so we really thought that we could be very big. Like, we could penetrate and get millions of customers and make their lives a lot easier. And so because of that, you're trying to move people that don't use any bookkeeping or accounting, probably don't even fully understand what that means, and you're trying to get them to use your product. Now, the only way that we really found to get people to understand deeply what our product does is to get them to try it. And then on top of it, when you think of marketing, like, how are you going to find customers? Well, you have a lot of companies that are really tiny, and we wanted to use them to generate word of mouth to find other businesses. So that really was the premise on how we were going to scale.
But you're thinking like an investor or someone who has an investor at a time when you don't. And I'm guessing that's because your plan all along was to build a funded company, right?
Yeah. I mean, yes. Because when we really looked at it and we saw the opportunity, I think that we started Outright at like one of the best times. And I think even at the time we were really excited about what we were doing, and we thought it was the right timing. So yes, we were thinking big, and we were thinking we would be raising capital.
Okay. You raise money. How does life change after that, after the first round?
Well, so one is you have a lot, you know, you have a lot of smart people on your team now. Like, you know, we already had smart people, but now you just get a different group of people that are looking at your business and being able to give you advice. The other thing is that before we were like, oh, yeah, we wanted to be large at some point, and that's what we thought we were going to do. At this point, it's like we signed on for that. Like, we definitely were doing that. Like, to pivot now and to say we're going to be a lifestyle business and generate, you know, tens of thousands in revenue a month was gone.
So here's what I understand about this space, and I don't know nearly as much as you do, but what it seems to me is that I sign up for a service like yours, my accountant says, I don't know what the hell this is. And I go, this is so much better than QuickBooks. It's easy for me to use, and you can log in and so on and all the things that you've told me. My accountant says, I don't have time right now. Just send me the QuickBooks file and I'll get your taxes done. Boom, you're shut down. And the other side is, before I even get to the point where I'm even that excited, I think, whoa, who am I giving my information to? I don't know these guys. I know QuickBooks. I know putting software on my computer is safe. So how do you get past those two? Which of those two is the biggest? We'll talk about that first, since I just threw two different questions at you.
So surprisingly, the accounts is not as big of a problem as you think. We actually hear a lot of stories of people going to accountants and accountants saying, use QuickBooks, and they're like, and they try it, and they're like, this is way too hard. And the accountants are like, well, that's what you should use. And then they end up saying, well, I'm going on my own, and then they find us. So that's like, we get a lot of stories like that.
And they still will, the accountant doesn't shut them down. They still continue to use you.
Yeah, so because what we do is we just allow them to do a PDF of their Schedule C. Essentially what we do is, at the end of the day, all of the software eventually generates the Schedule C. You give that to your accountant, and then they do the rest for you. And so that is like our integration points with accountants. And that's worked well. Now, people that get really picky and want an accountant, and they will tend to use QuickBooks. And truthfully, we are not trying to move people off of QuickBooks. Like, if you're large enough to use QuickBooks and you've gone through the complexity of learning QuickBooks and you have and you can afford accountants and bookkeepers and all this stuff and you don't have to deal with it, well, go ahead and use QuickBooks. We're building our product for people that don't have that expertise, don't have the time or the knowledge to work on that. So, and they can't really afford accountants or bookkeeper in the traditional sense. Like maybe at the end of the year, they have someone to help with their taxes, but not the way you think like an accountant who works with you all the time.
I see. I think that's why I started using Outright back when you guys launched. It was, I just needed to know how much money I'm earning from a few small products that I'm selling. And it didn't make sense to hire a bookkeeper to tell me that, but products like PayPal don't tell you. You can't get a good report from PayPal that says this week you sold 30 orders of product X and 50 orders of product Y, and here the customer. You don't get that.
Yeah, and not only that, like PayPal knows that, and they see the value in Outright, and that's why we have such a great partnership. Like, I mean, they had us fly out to their call centers and teach all of the representatives more about Outright because customers are calling in asking these questions, and they don't have answers, and they're not planning on adding that anytime soon. So they now have a solution. They say, oh, here, well, why don't you try something like Outright?
So you quickly realize that you need to start working with PayPal. And with PayPal, I think I could just authorize your account so that you can go and pull in my data, right?
And that's how the second question was like, oh, okay, well, now you're coming into the software and you're going to give your bank credentials and your accounts. So I think a part of that is that we don't officially touch the credentials. So we get keys, like PayPal allows us like this token to access your account, which is read only. So at that point, it's less about, well, can this company move money around? And now it's like, well, there is a privacy issue here, right? Where now I have your financial transactions. Can't move money. So it's a different level. And then on top, so what we do for that is, you know, we just do, I mean, we work a lot on security, making sure that we're protecting your data, and we spend time on making sure our site is, you know, safe and secure, and we're storing the data in a way that's, you know, protects you.
What do you used to do to reassure people, to tell them all that when you're just creating a landing page?
Well, so, I mean, some of the types of things you can do is, you know, is you can show the types of SSL, sir. You can say the types of security audits you do. But what's really funny is at the end of the day, like a lot of those things are words, and you're just that's you're telling them these are the practices. But no end user actually understands like what does 128-bit encryption mean and where are you using that encryption. Like these things, like people just don't understand. What's interesting is Wasabi, the founder, I think Mark, he wrote a really interesting blog post about Wasabi and how when they launched, they were like, so security conscious. They spent a lot of energy on this. They actually had a key that not even like their support could actually know what your financial transactions were to your account without you actually typing in your password. And they actually said that's one of the main reasons why Mint beat them because Mint actually said, just give us the credentials. We'll connect and do that. Wasabi originally had a desktop client that would upload to their website. I think, you know, essentially what he eventually said is that ease of use is more important. It trumps security. and Mint really kind of proved a lot of that where you saw their sign-up experience and you're getting bank credentials. Well, yeah, they overcame that and people continue to do that and feel comfortable. And I think we found the same where people are a little bit nervous about it. And then, you know, we do our best to reassure them that it's safe and we do great security practices. But at the end of the day, they make that leap of faith.
You add PayPal so that people can quickly integrate. What's the next big milestone for the company?
So really, I think the first, we added FreshBooks, we added eBay, and then we added PayPal. And we really started proving out how are we going to acquire customers. So SEM did not end up working. Like essentially, I can't remember what the cost to acquire a user was, but it was too expensive. So we were going through various ways of acquiring customers, and the one that ended up working really well is partnerships. And so I think that was the biggest thing that we proved right away, which was, hey, we can actually acquire a lot of customers for very little money by partnering.
What's an early partnership that did that?
So, I mean, FreshBooks was the first one. We raised our seed round on it. eBay was the second one. We raised our Series A off of it.
What was the partnership with eBay?
So eBay, they have eBay Open Apps, and it allows you to embed your product inside of eBay. Kind of think like Facebook apps inside of eBay, and it's for sellers. So what's so great about it is you show up in an app store, they click one button, and you've just reduced the friction so much that they literally click start using Outright. We hook their eBay account to Outright. We create their account. We grab eBay credentials and sync all their data. In less than 1 minute, we can show you all your history that we can get of your sales, best customers, best product, tax implications, all of that stuff in like less than 1 minute by clicking one button. And these eBay customers have just, they've never seen this data. Like, these are people that have been running a business. They just do not have this level of detail. And they were just thrilled. And then immediately we had them add PayPal. And then you get another picture of their business. Then they can add their credit card. And I think that's how we really got over the bank and credit card. Is we build credibility by doing the lower, what people consider lower security, like giving access to eBay or FreshBooks, people are less concerned about than adding their bank account. So by proving the value with these ones where they're not as secure conscious really helps get people over the hump when they start adding that bank account or that credit card.
I see. How hard was it to get the integration with eBay, to get eBay to work with you on it?
Well, so we had some good connections. One of our, Mark Andreessen was an angel, and Ben Horowitz was, they had an angel fund before Andreessen Horowitz, and they were angel investors, and they have very good ties with eBay. And we happen to know some people at eBay. So we were invited into their, into being like a launch partner of the open eBay apps. So, I mean, it actually went really smooth. And because of that, we actually, we're the first people on their platform and work directly with their engineering team on helping them improve it and to say like, oh, here, if you change your APIs this way, it would work better for us. I think the biggest thing there was preparing for more scale than we were definitely ready for. I think we had a couple co-load servers. I moved us to AWS at that time. So preparing for scale and then a lot of the security audits and things that we start prepare for, that all happened at that time. And there were some big hurdles there because eBay is, they only integrate with, you need a certain level of security and scalability to be able to integrate with them. And we did a lot of that work then.
Do you remember what do you remember how fast your customer base grew because of that? Like, how many people were you adding a week before and how many after that integration with eBay?
Don't remember the exact number, but I would say it's at least 6 to 10x what was previous. And for a while, eBay was the our largest channel for growth.
What took over after eBay?
So organic now is larger. Once you get a larger customer base, the word of mouth spreads more. I would say that's probably is what ended up doing it. But eBay is still extremely popular for us.
You became the number one app on eBay.
Yeah. Yep, number one. We won. They had a year where they gave out awards for their apps. We won. I can't even remember the award, but it's a little Einstein doll. We won that for the developer conference.
And then customer acquisition just became zero from eBay after you built it out.
Yeah, I mean, so that almost every one of our partnerships is not, it's not like a bounty. We're not paying per customer. Most of these companies like PayPal and eBay actually see the value so much. And same with FreshBooks. They see the value for their customers. Their customers are asking for these things. So they actually, they send them their way because it's what they do. That's what's right for their customers.
And so with FreshBooks, it's just an integration. Anyone can integrate with FreshBooks. And then they list you in their list of software that they integrate with, right? Yeah. And still, that's powerful.
Yeah. So what you tend to find is that people who do professional services and use FreshBooks, they build like a little mini community of people talking about the software that they're using and how they're using it. And so you're putting yourself into that conversation.
Right.
When you think of the small businesses, this is why it's so hard to acquire small businesses is they're so fragmented. Like if you really took all these small businesses and you're like, okay, well, how many of them, you have lawyers in there, you have gardeners in there. Well, how many lawyers are recommending to gardeners accounting software, right? Like this is not, that's not who they talk to. Lawyers are going to talk to other like lawyers, and you know, and so so how do you send a message to all of these people to use software? It's pretty tough. So the way we did it was through partnerships and trying to really create, you know, smaller ponds where people are all talking to each other. And that's the way we were trying to build word of mouth.
That little ding dong that popped up as we were talking was actually me being on snapengage.com, where they of course pop up that little, hey, I'm live, can I talk to you? The founder of SnapEngage in his interview with me said that was the number one place for him to get new customers. He would just quickly integrate with another, with other software, and boom, he'd get more exposure, more customers, and so on. In fact, I'm on his website right now. I see desk.com. It, more logos of people who he integrates with, I think, than his, that takes up more space than his own logo, and I could understand why. What I'm wondering is, once you get eBay and you get FreshBooks, do you start going on a tear and partnering up with everyone? And if you do, what's the result of that?
Yeah, so we almost, like, so we're close there. We actually have our back end is, like, able to do that. We have a very general back end. The biggest thing is that we're continuing to build, improve our product, and now we're working on a lot of scaling initiatives that we just haven't been able to finish that vision yet. But it's something that we're working on. And yes, you will see that soon, because data flowing is like one of the most important parts of our software, is that when you come in, you hook in, like for your business, here are the 7 different accounts that I use, hook them all in, be able to bring in the data, and then you have real-time financial dashboard of what's happening in your business. And right now, if we only support 3 of those 7, you'll see a portion of your business, not the whole thing. And you can fill that in by typing it in, but then, you know, that's work, and we want to eliminate work.
The way that you can, I understand the way you partner up with PayPal. I understand eBay integration. But once you start to go to Citibank, which I think I've connected to your system, you guys need to work with Yodlee, right?
Yes.
Yodlee gets that data for you from my account. Yodlee is notoriously bad at this stuff. Their system breaks. You see people complain about them on Twitter. You see people complain about them on blogs like TechCrunch. How many people did you need to have a day managing the Yodlee integration?
So when we added Yodlee, we had probably a two to three person team working and iterating that. And we're still have to work on that. And there's a lot of, I mean, they supply we use about 5,000 financial institutions through Yodlee and then maintain those. And so we still have a team of probably like one person that's maintaining. And then we're, like I said, we're heavily working on scale. Like we're scaling, preparing to scale 10X architectural changes. So we have another 2 people working on architectural changes to be able to support the growth.
So basically, to keep them going, you need to have 2-3 people who are working with you for Yodlee. What about customer support? My data isn't in your system. I'm pissed off at you. I don't understand Yodlee.
So we then have to work with ticketing. Essentially, what happens is, yeah, there's a problem that occurs. Customer talks to us. Now we have to go escalate it to Yodlee to fix the problem. And if they aren't going to fix it, that looks bad on us. Like, yeah, you can't say, oh, it's Yodlee's fault. Like, we chose to use Yodlee. It's our fault. that does create, that does make it hard. And we have been thinking of other, you know, of things like maybe integrating directly to the top 10 financial institutions in the country, which covers 80%, you know. So maybe doing that, and then we actually control our destiny.
What's the challenge with doing that? I feel like, What was the percentage that you said of people who use the top 10 banks?
Like 90%,
right? We're mostly, people who are listening to me right now are using Citibank, they're using Chase, they're using Wells Fargo, these major banks. What's the challenge of just working directly with those banks? I always used to assume that's what you guys did.
Yeah, no. So mainly, I mean, it's just like anything. You have limited resources. Where you're going to spend your time? At the beginning, and even to this day, we can have a team build that and maintain those things, but then they're not building other features or making our product faster. And so it's just a resource allocation thing, the way you think about it. It's a cost thing as well. Like Yodlee, you have to now pay for all those financial institutions, so that is more expensive. And if you then do it yourself, you don't have to pay those fees anymore. So there, I think there will be a day where we have to do that, just to provide the level of customer, the product to the level of which we want. You know, like, I think we're gonna have to control that stuff to some degree.
I was just doing an interview, a rare interview with a restaurant owner. I usually focus on tech. But what I learned from him was that churn can really kill the income statement or rip a big hole in it, because he says, think about it. We have to find a new person to come in. We have to take time out of all of our people here to sit and interview the person. We have to train them. We have to pay for this. We have to do all these expenses. If that waiter then ends up quitting within a couple of weeks, or you have to fire him within a month, it adds up and you have to just keep spending more money. I'm wondering, you get a lot of customers from eBay, but they're small business owners who often will go out of business or leave because of some other reason. Is there a price to, what is the price of churn then?
Yeah, so that is actually interesting. We did, I wish I had the data, but we actually did some investigation on churn and how much of it was because of businesses turning over. And surprisingly, most of our customers have been in business for, I think it's like two to five years. When you look at the small business data, most of them are churning out in the first 2 years. And then after that, it somewhat stabilizes. So we actually see less, like, I started my company yesterday, I'm using Outright, and then they fail 9 months later. We more see the people that have done it for the first year and they say, oh man, taxes, that was gnarly. And then they're learning from that and they're going, okay, what am I going to do about that? And then they talk to an accountant, and then QuickBooks is too hard, and then eventually they find us or something to this degree. And so by the time the companies that are a little bit more mature, like after 2 years, you'll see that the churn drops significantly. I don't have the exact data. I'd have to look it up, but that is something that we looked at to see the actual cost. And so with that, we actually correlated across our customer base. And you see, we're not losing lots because they're going out of business, actually.
I see. You told April something that was surprising to me. You said that acquiring small businesses is very challenging. You want coffee shop, well, what is it? Coffee shops, engineers, all run businesses slightly different, right? They run businesses slightly different. They don't talk to each other. There isn't an easy place. I always assumed that business owners would be easy to find. They're not.
No, definitely not. There's just, you know, really when you see when really talking to our customers in small businesses, it's actually a fairly lonely, place. You're kind of on your own. You know, you may have one employee or none. You don't have a lot of like support in your network to talk about the challenges. And that leads over, like, it's kind of a lonely lifestyle for the business owner, but then also there's a lot of them out there kind of isolated. So there's not like a community that brings together all of these different diverse small businesses, or there's none of significant size that you could just like, oh, I built this software, I'm going to advertise on this network and bam, I have all these businesses. Like, it just, that doesn't exist yet.
Is there a big community out there of a specific kind of person? Like, is there a Hacker News of dry cleaners, or a Reddit for software consultants where they all get together, is there anything like that?
I mean, that's actually kind of what we do, is we start looking at the overall pie of small business that would be right for Outright. And mainly one of the things is that they're not a cash business, right? Like, one of the premises, we tap into all your electronic data sources. So if it's a cash business, we just can't tap into that. So we take that, we look for people that have electronic data trails, and then we start looking for pockets of communities, because that's the way we think about it. Well, so this product will work for them. How are we going to find them? And then you find pools of people. And so, yeah, I can't say for dry cleaners, because I haven't looked at dry cleaners, but we have looked at real estate agents, insurance brokers, like, you know, you can, like, professional services, like law firms.
And what do you do if you find a law firm site, an online community for them? Do you start to advertise in there? Do you start to chat?
Yeah, so I mean, a lot of things we do is so we'll do it. Like Etsy is a good example. So we actually go like we go to with Etsy and we find out who is the Etsy. Like in most communities, you're going to have a select few that are really influential, and the ones that are organizing and talking about things. Those are the people, you know, you want those evangelists. You want them to come. You want to talk to them, show them your software, and get them on board. And then they are the ones who are really going to carry the messages across to the whole community. So you really just need those kind of ambassadors that believe in your product, and you integrate them in, like take their feedback seriously, incorporate into the product so it's great and they believe in it, and they will do a lot of messaging for you.
How big are you guys with Etsy?
So Etsy is probably our third, well, it would be our third largest data source.
So it's eBay, Etsy, and?
It would be like PayPal.
PayPal. Wow. All right. So here's some of the challenges that you talked to April about in the pre-interview. You said that, I hate to even say this out loud, but you felt comfortable enough to bring it up in the notes. You have an issue with interpersonal skills. Now I'm talking to you we've talked for a while before the interview. We've talked for about 50 minutes in the interview at this point. I don't see it. How did it used to play out?
Okay, so I mean, over time, I've practiced that, you know, just being better at, you know, like going to conferences and talking to people. Like, I mean, I would literally have to work on it. I would say, like, I'm going to a conference, and there's going to be this party. I have to talk to 15 people. Even if I just say hi, I have to go up to 15 people I don't know, say hi, and talk to them. So I just constantly work on it. When I was into it, I forced myself every year to do tech talk. Like they did this yearly tech talk where you talk in front of the whole company. So I forced myself to do those types of things. So I get that it's really continuing to practice. And then it's really on managing. So, you know, my role really changed from being hands-on coder to managing a team, like recruiting a team of engineers and then making sure that they have the freedom to get things done and to give them the right amount of direction to get the right things done, but not over, don't be a micromanager. Like it's this balance that I never really thought much about until I was really put in that position and made mistakes, you know, either being too micro, like saying, oh, here, do it, and here's the 8 steps to do it. And people don't like that. They want the freedom to figure it out. To the other extreme, which would be like, oh, do this thing, and then they don't do it right. Well, I told them literally this thing, you know. And to me, like, oh, you can't read my mind? That's surprising. Anyways, I think that's the thing that I really had to work on when growing the team and growing the company.
One of the things that I'm looking forward to doing more of now that I'm in San Francisco is having private conversations with people where they tell me what happens in secret. And I had a drinks event the other day, and I found out about a major entrepreneur who we all know and respect, who this woman worked with him, and she said, I saw a fight break out in front of him with two of his people, and he just didn't know what to do. He just sat there quietly because he didn't know how to interrupt it, you know, and how to calm them down because he just wasn't experienced enough with interpersonal skills. And I thought, I had that issue too. It's still in my mind where I saw two people argue and I said, well, I can't tell them to shut up. What am I going to do? I can't. I just stood there like an idiot, like a weakling. And I still flash on that moment. I know exactly where I was. Do you have anything like that? Was there an issue like that that made you say, oof, I need some help here?
I had some issues where it was like I had more junior engineers and they coded. So this is like, I would say like one of the biggest mistakes. So they coded something. I was not happy with it. I told them I was not happy with it in public. And man, I had just no idea like how much that affects people, especially when they're younger. And really when I look at it, like they made mistakes that probably I would have made when I was a more junior engineer. And to really just like to reflect on that and to put myself in their shoes. That's the stuff, you know, that I think that was one of the biggest mistakes that I made because it just really hurt the morale and it didn't solve, like that doesn't solve anything, right? It just really, all it's doing is it's making them feel bad when they were really crying. And
you got a personal coach to help you with it?
I mean, so a lot of that stuff I read and, you know, like there's this book called Managing Humans. I've read that. I just read a lot, and I think about it a lot. That's, you know, I try to put myself in other people's, in the other perspective, and to think like, well, if I were there, what would I have done? And then you have to be careful though, because you also are running a business. So even if, so you have to make sure that you have like empathy for what's going on, but you also have to make sure that people are doing a great job. And some people try really hard and they just can't get it. They can't do it as well as other people. Like, that is the facts. And just because they're trying doesn't mean that they should necessarily be on your team. So that to me is kind of tricky, is where is that line of, yeah, you try, but yeah, okay. But if you try forever and you never get anything right, well, I want people who get things right on my team. Like, that's like what, you know, you want to build a team, people that succeed over time.
Let's see what else there's. Here's another thing that I wanted to ask you about from April's notes. You learn the importance of presenting ideas from other people's point of view to speak their language. And this was with investors, but did you do that with customers too? Did you find that there's a certain way that they talk, and if you talk their language, you're more likely to get them as users?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's just in general, you should always do that. Now, when you work in your own circles, like when I'm an engineer and I work with other engineers in that circle, well, I am already kind of seeing that because I see it the same way they do in general. Like, we're very close in our educational background. It's when you really start switching to, yeah, like investors, like they've been doing totally different things for their whole career compared to engineering. And they just look at things totally different than you do. So I think I definitely spent time on understanding how do investors look at PowerPoint or this chart, like a cohort chart. It's amazing if you go put a cohort chart in an investor with all of these different lines. When I first saw a cohort chart, I'm like staring at it, like, okay, I'm really thinking hard about it. You show an investor a cohort chart, they're like, they could tell right away, like, oh, in August, your conversion rate improved by X percent. I'm like, what the hell? How do you see that? Oh, the band moved by X, like, much. And it's amazing, like, the amount of information they can gather from that one chart. So what I did is, as soon as I started noticing that, I actually went to an investor and said, like, here, show me, how do you look at businesses? Show me, sometimes they showed me decks of other portfolio companies and what they presented. And then you start seeing these patterns, like, of how they look at customer churn and the types of charts that they expect to see when you show churn. Mm. When you present, you're no longer fighting over the form factor, right? Like, you know the data is important. You put it in a way in which they can immediately understand it. And now they're no longer having to actually think about the form factor. They're just looking at the raw data right away. And to me, that's how, when you start to understand that and your whole board meeting is like that, you now cut through trying to understand the data, and it's way more on, great, I've seen data like this before, and if you do, and I've seen, like, these two activities improve that. You know, and that's the type of stuff that I think the board really helped on the most, was they see, like, 10s, 20s of other startups, and they can do a lot of pattern matching. They can say, like, oh, well, your churn rate is 30%. Well, I have 9 other companies, and their churn rates are 50%. So actually, you're actually doing a good job. Maybe you shouldn't spend as much energy on reducing churn, because, like, I have data that says you're actually doing really well there. Maybe you should focus further up in the funnel.
I'm looking at your site to see, is this company growing after the sale to GoDaddy, or is it an acquihire, or what? And I see that there is a jobs list. You guys are really soliciting new people here on this job board. It's kind of different when you're hiring around here. I see that there's outings, and you've got, is that you in a race car?
Yeah.
And I guess you take your team out to do that. I see cycling. Is it tough? What's it like to compete for people here?
I mean, it's tough. I actually think it's got me really good, like, you know, it's got me really good at recruiting and understanding what makes engineers happy. I pay a lot of attention to this because, like, we're a company that builds products and requires engineers, and we need great engineers. So I build an environment that great engineers thrive in. That's, like, what I think about all the time. And yeah, so some of the race car, yeah, we went to Laguna Seca and raced at Formula Cars. But we also, in 6 months, grew 7x by engineers working really hard on that. So I think you've got to reward people for working hard and getting things done and real results.
Are you a millionaire as a result of the sale?
Hi.
You can say that.
I
I think you're saying you can't say that.
I don't want to allude to anything.
Okay.
Yeah, I it's you have to realize that I'm actually really open, so it really wouldn't bother me. It's more, we just decided not to disclose financials about it.
Okay. All right. I think I've got an answer. I think I'm reading between the lines here and I've got an answer. Let me take a step back. I go bigger picture like you did with investors. Why isn't there a big mint-sized exit in the business financial accounting software space? I would think that when it came to managing money, that consumers would be the ones who are reluctant to do it. They would be the ones who'd be harder to find, and that businesses would jump in there, that they would kill for an iPhone app the way that Mint has it, that they would kill for a web page that they could sit down and be their dashboard, that they would talk nonstop about it, that they would pull it out more than they'd pull out Twitter at events and see where's my money at? Where's the health of my company?
Yeah, so I think, I think if we executed slightly different, we could have been exactly there.
How?
So we had some real troubles, like in getting activated people. So coming in and going through that funnel and getting their data set up, and that was a tough nut to crack. And one of the things we did was pivoted, and we pivoted away from freemium. And when we did that, I mean, that pivot and then pivoting back. So essentially we go to say, oh, we're going to charge. And then, yes, activation rates went like so high. Everyone activated after that
When you
because.
say we're no longer offering a free intro, you have to pay if you're interested. Of course, everyone who pays is going to activate.
Like we was like, oh, well, I'll get all the activation. But then how do you acquire customers? And we just couldn't figure it out. And you're like, you have to do the freemium and you have to crack the activation nut. So then we went back and we said, okay, we're doing the freemium, and we actually got the activation rate working. However, that whole stint there took like 11 months away from us, all of that. And that 11 months, I think that if we executed really well in that 11 months, figured out activation, and then went on to finish a couple other things, we could be in a different spot.
Meaning, always go freemium, get as many people to use the software as possible, and then spend time figuring out how to get those people to use it. That would have helped you grow.
Yes, I think we would have been in a different spot. Now I think we're still going to, I mean, 2013 is going to be huge for us. I think we will become the number one solution for small businesses in the world, and I think we will then continue in 2014 to kill it. So I actually think I think we're on the right path to win. Now to do it, we were acquired first, and now we have a huge pool of GoDaddy customers to market to. So I think we're still going to hit the long-term vision. It required this additional step. And I think if we potentially executed a little bit earlier, we would have had another, 10 months to execute. And I think, who knows? I can't predict, but I think we could have potentially done it on our own. But I think it was the right.
Why did you sell?
We sold because I think it was good for our investors. It was great for our customers. We get to now continue to build our product and give it and have more people using it. It's great for our employees. I think across every single thing that I look at when raising capital or an exit, it was a check mark on it.
Did your investors try to get you to hold off?
No, no, no. So,
Did you have enough cash to keep going for another year?
no.
Not as it was.
So we would have to do it. We have a Series B. So our options was a Series B or an acquisition. We had both of those options. So it wasn't like we had we had multiple options. We had four options. So this is not like one thing that we had to do.
you know what? I still don't understand why more businesses don't use it. And the reason that I say it is because I look at I sit down in the morning, I look at Hacker News, I look at like Drudge and Huffington, like to get my mind going in the morning, I'll sometimes do that. But I'll always look at where my finances are. Did we screw up? Am I in trouble? Is everything okay? And because I have it, I use a different system. I also have an Outright account that I've had for years, but I use a different system. Because it's all there, I see it all. I see Citibank, I see PayPal. Boom, it's beautiful. I don't get why more businesses don't start out the day that way. You know what? You told me, I'm not doing this for flattery. You gave me some insight earlier on. You said, it's really tough to tag income. And you're right, that becomes a real nasty pain in the butt to have to go in and say, this is income because someone paid me back for getting them lunch and they sent it to me via PayPal, but that is a new order for a product. That's one of the issues. And it takes forever to do where Mint doesn't have to do it. What else is there?
So I actually think tagging income is the thing, like the better you do there, the better the experience is and the better businesses can run. I think the next really hard thing is to move from the level of, we're at a point where we give you lots of data and you can run reports. But if you don't know what reports to run or what to look at, it's fairly tough. Like when I ran consulting, if you're trying to grow a consulting, so people have different goals, right? Like some people are like, hey, I want a business where I get $10,000 a month and I'm happy. Some people want to grow 10%, you know, a year. Who knows what these things are, right? So it's really, what do they want to do? And then, and giving them the insights. I think that's the next real important thing that we do is put real meaning into that data and to help people run their business more effectively when they don't know necessarily what to do. And I think that is a doable thing. When you look at different business models, there are different levers for those business models. And if we can expose those things back behind data, I think that's going to be really huge for our customers.
You're right, because for me, I love the report that says who's your most valuable customer, but if I click on that, it doesn't give me much because all my customers essentially pay the same. But I could see how that would be useful to someone else. For me, the more useful data would be how long is a customer staying with you, and I'm wondering if that report exists somewhere.
Yeah. And that's exactly right. And if you're like a freelancer, there's really, like if you're a consulting company, there's two ways to grow your business. You charge more per hour, you bill more hours. That's like, those are the two options that you have. And if you're going to bill more hours, well, you can only work so much, and then you have to start hiring. Okay, if you want to increase your hourly rate, well, there's only so much you can increase your hourly rate to. So if your goals are outside of those, you're going to have to start managing people or something to this effect. So I think those are just things that, and every type of business have those models behind it.
Yeah, absolutely. You know what? I got to ask the audience, please tell me, if you guys don't start your day looking at this stuff, tell me why. Is it that you feel bad about it? Is it that you feel it becomes a distraction from the day? I'm so curious. I got to find out. What else do I want to find out? I think that's everything that I want. Oh, you know what? Here's a final question. I asked you at the beginning, before we even recorded this interview, what's a win for you? What are you looking for? And what you said was, you know what, Andrew, when I built up my business, I got a ton of advice. It was all helpful. It helped me build up my company. And now it's my opportunity. I sold to GoDaddy. Life is easier now. I want to return what I've got. And so let me ask you this. What's one piece of advice that you got that was so valuable that you now want to pass it on to the audience?
I think one of the most valuable things when starting a business that you want to get large, so if you're trying to build a large startup, I think is to really start changing the way you look. So look at your business as a machine, right? You have customers coming that are generating revenue and understand the pieces of that machine and what is important and what isn't. And I think by really dissecting and really understanding those pieces and then measuring those is how you can have a chance of being successful. Because
isn't it easy to see what's important and what's not? What's something in your business that would seem important, but really, if you think about it, it's not?
So I would think some are... Okay, so like customers ask for lots of different features, and I think it's sometimes hard to say no to people, but I think by keeping things simple and saying no to adding complexity to your software, you make it better for everyone, And yes, certain people are going to miss certain pieces. I think like keeping simplicity, like, so we have simplicity as the number one thing. We want to be large. We want, and so we always look at that and we're always measuring like how we're doing. And that's why we, like, for example, always measure our net promoter score. It's automated. We always see it and we always keep a close eye on that and making sure that like we have high quality and it's easy to use. I don't know. That's a great example.
I'm trying to think of what might seem important. Writing checks. QuickBooks can print checks, but you wouldn't think that that would be important in your business.
Maybe focus on electronic. So I think it's the things, though, where there's just so much data. Like, we collect a lot of data, and it's like, what data matters and what doesn't? Mm-hmm. You know, like, when is a customer, you know, like, you're always trying to predict when someone, like, the leap to revenue, and then, and what that looks like. So that's when I say machine. It's really like, hey, when we, you want it to be a machine where, like, if we ran an SEM campaign, we know for $6 we can get up to this many users coming and signing up. You need to figure out what that number is, or if it doesn't work. Like, okay, so if for us SEM didn't work, like, we had to acquire customers for like $10. Well, that's too much. So we immediately cross that off the list and we say, okay, great. What's our next idea for acquiring customers? And when you're raising that Series B, you really want to be able to go in and say, like, look, to run our business successfully, here are the six things we have to execute on, and here are the all the stuff that we're doing now to show that those six things work. And we just need to pump money into them. And that's, I think that's what you're trying to figure out, is you're trying to figure out that scalable business model. So you always have to think, what are the levers and how are we going to build processes to make sure that all of those pieces are working in unison?
And that makes sense. I remember when I interviewed Noah Kagan, he said that when he worked at Facebook, Mark Zuckerberg would keep saying in the early days, we want growth, 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 growth. And so any decision had to lead back to growth, anything that they did either led back to growth or wasn't important. And he said when he started his own company soon after that, he didn't have that. He had all this data and he just kept going for more and more data.
Yeah, and it's really hard, and you have to keep it simple. Like, if you're communicating to 30 people, like, if you can communicate 40 things to them, like, that means essentially nothing's important. Like, you have to say, out of all of the things you can do, what are the next two things that you should do, and you should do them well, and focus everyone around those things, and measure that they actually make a difference. Don't just put features out and say, like, oh yeah, that's great, we shipped a feature. It's only good if that feature actually makes improvement in one of your core business metrics. Otherwise, what are you doing this for?
All right. The website is outright.com. You guys can go and sign up and connect all your financial networks to it right away. And if Yodlee is good that day, then you'll get all your bank data in. But actually, regardless, you're going to get all your data in an easy to digest summary. Thank you so much for doing this interview, Ben.
Come
at me. All right. Congratulations on the sale. And thank you all for being a part of it. Bye, guys.